On this episode of The Playbook, we have Fritz Landman, CEO of ClassPass, but an extraordinary entrepreneur and investor, and he's going to teach us how to take a small investment and make it huge. He's done it several different times. Join me for all of this and more on The Playbook. This is Entrepreneurs The Playbook, where each week I bring you some of the greatest athletes, celebrities, and entrepreneurs to talk about their personal and professional playbook to success and what made them champions on the field and in the boardroom. I'm your host, David Meltzer. I'm so excited. I have Fritz Landman. He is the CEO of ClassPass and, of course, a serial entrepreneur, investor, the usual, but his story is not usual because he's actually personally involved with the company. And I think that's why it does so well. Fritz, welcome to The Playbook.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Good. You know, it's so interesting because I love a story where an entrepreneur actually is involved or excited about a company before they get involved. And you ended up not only utilizing ClassPass, but re-engineering it to suit what you saw were the critical business issues and the value that you could bring. Give me a little bit of backstory on where you started with ClassPass and why you were so excited about getting involved.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's funny. It's kind of a unique story because I first was involved, as you alluded to, as an investor. So I met Pyle and her co-founders when they were actually, the company was a different name, and it was called Classtivity. And they had had the idea to pivot it to a recurring membership subscription, and they were going to change the brand to ClassPass. And so they were raising capital to kind of pivot their business. And so I led that round and brought in a group of really great top kind of tech angel investors and seed funds to give them a shot. And then I just got really involved. Like the minute I met Pyle in New York City, I committed to invest probably in, 15 minutes, because I just believed that, this industry, fitness and wellness, has so much excess capacity. And kind of like in the food delivery world, it doesn't make sense to me that like people should have to just work out at one location for all of their fitness routine, right? Like, it's like, that'd be like eating at the same restaurant every time you order out, right? So it really just made sense that given the amount of excess capacity in space, given that most of the players in the space are small business merchants who don't have huge marketing budgets, and to really need help kind of bringing foot traffic into the doors. And on the consumer side, just felt like, the best way to work out is a variety routine. One day I can go do a yoga class, and the next day I can go to a CrossFit class, and then go to a traditional gym and hit the weights, and then do a boxing class or a spin class. And so I just really bought into the concept, I guess, committed to investing, led the seed round, and then started just because I was so passionate about it and had really different kind of skills and experiences from the founders. I was a bit more technical of a background. I was kind of helping them, with recruiting and product strategy. And then I actually led the next financing, which was their Series A, and became the executive chairman of the business. So Pyle sort of recruited me to invest, and then she made me an advisor, and then she kind of got me to invest a lot more money and become the chairman of the business. And so that was great for about a year. And then one day she called me and said, "Hey, I need you to actually step in and run the company."
And what reservations did you have? It's a big difference in being an investor and playing the surface game compared to digging deep and being in the operations administration strategy of a business like this. And I know your own personal journey allowed you to utilize the services to lose weight yourself and to have better mindset and heart set and wellness within the context of what you provided. But it is a big difference. And a lot of entrepreneurs make that transition. It's like in an analogous situation, you take your top salesperson and you make them into a manager. And what you've done is lost your top salesman and have a shitty manager. That happens totally a lot with entrepreneurs that come in and run the business. Did you have any reservation, or were there any, things that you were like, "Oh man, I've made a mistake," or "This is a lot more difficult than, or a lot deeper than I wanted to go"?
It's a great question. I'm different than most investors in that I'm not a full-time investor. And even now when I invest in businesses, it's nights and weekends. And I started it, my first angel investment was Square, which Jack Dorsey turned into a behemoth. And then like my third or fourth was Pinterest and I'd gone to Yale with the Pinterest guys, and then got to invest in their seed round. And then my sixth or seventh was another monster one called Wish. And I got really lucky out of the gate. So I was like, oh, this investing thing, which started as a nights and weekends thing, is actually kind of profitable. But more importantly, it was just super fun, super interesting. And it was making me a better operator. By then I'd left Microsoft, where I was running a corporate strategy group, and had started a company. And me trading notes as a founder with my founders that I was investing in was making me a better founder and making me a better investor. So there was a kind of a positive reinforcement loop between my investing activity and my operating activity. So when Pyle asked me to step in full time and take the reins in the end of 2015, I was very confident as an operator, and I knew the business so well, and I knew Pyle so well, and I knew kind of our interests were very complementary. I was super confident on that side, and I kind of developed a vision for how we could evolve our business model that I thought would solve some of the problems that we had with our first model. So I was pretty confident from opportunity, vision, alignment, what I could personally bring from a technical and kind of business strategy standpoint, confident in my recruiting abilities because I was running other companies. The main apprehension I had was I had just left the West Village. My wife is pregnant, having a baby in San Francisco. ClassPass had an office there. I had two other companies that I was serving as executive chairman of, and I was angel investing. So I had tried to be just like a kind of a player coach, chairman of these other businesses that I helped incubate. And ultimately as an operator, I just couldn't help but to get really involved in them. And so when Pyle asked me to do it, I was deeply involved with my two other companies plus my 80 odd angel investments. And so it was more of a lifestyle question. Like, my God, this is going to mean I'm bi-coastal with a newborn with these other businesses. And luckily my partners in the other businesses were really, talented, and they had brought in some senior executive talent. So my sort of need was less than it had been. And then they sold eventually. So, I decided to go for it and try it for a year. It was my original deal with Pyle. Like, let's do it for a year and see how it goes. And if at the end of that, if it goes well and I can handle it living bi-coastally, then great. And what happened was everything was going great in terms of the business being turned around and the model being fixed. And I had a really big vision for bringing machine learning, revenue optimization to these small businesses, which we've now executed against. Can talk more about that. The problem was, from a personal standpoint, it was killing me. I was 36. I gained a ton of weight for the first time in my life. I'm a former athlete, and I was like completely overweight. My doctor said, hey, Fritz, you're 35 or whatever I was at the time, and you've got really elevated cholesterol, and you've got a newborn daughter. If you want to be around to see her the rest of your life, you probably need to get a handle on this. And, having been an athlete with a high metabolism, I never had to really worry about it as much before. But being on a plane bi-coastal every 3 or 4 days for, 18 months had caught up with me, and working, 110 hours a week and stuff. And so I was in terrible shape. So that was the biggest cost actually from joining. Luckily, I was able to turn that around and actually use our product to help solve that problem.
That's awesome. I used to say, as I was in my mid-30s, gained 47 pounds, I used to tell my wife, well, round is a shape, because I played college sports and said, oh, yeah, I'm in shape. She's like, exactly. Round is a shape. But pivoting and learning, you've had great lessons, some great mentors. Obviously, Jack is a friend of mine, been on the show as well. And I still learn lessons about that space with Square and what those guys are doing. And it seems to be synergistic to you re-engineering people's beliefs on what can be done in underutilized or fast-growing space. What are some of the lessons that you've learned in pivoting, not just business pivoting, but you've moved the business outside the city, you've changed your own lifestyle. That's another pivot. But there's some certain lessons that I want to get into with you, because you're so good at it, that you've learned about just the concept of keeping your options open, looking for opportunity when accelerated change occurs, how you deal with uncertainty, all of these different things. You must have some sort of philosophy or strategy that you utilize to end up what I call pain, taking it and indicating you can get to a better place. It doesn't necessarily have to stop you.
It's a good question. There's so many lessons. I think the two fundamental lessons that I've learned at ClassPass, but also in other experiences as an entrepreneur and as an investor in some really successful companies, has been, first is that the only sort of thing that's consistent is that everything's changing, right? Even look at Square. Square IPO'd. It was predominantly a point of sale payments company. Now, most of the market cap creation in the last 18 months or 20 or 36 months has been driven by Square Cash, which was a product that didn't even exist, you know, certainly when I invested, but even its like last private financing round. So, I learned that lesson when I invested in Facebook at Microsoft. We put $250 million into Facebook super early on. And a guy named Matt Kohler there, who became a partner at Benchmark afterwards and had been successful at LinkedIn before that, you know, I was asking him, how does he feel about Facebook's ability to move outside of colleges? And then they're going to add high schools. You know, first it was Ivy League only, then it was all colleges, then it was high schools, then it was, you know, parents. And my mom was able to join. And I was like, are you worried that people are going to leave when the dynamic changes? And he had an insight, which is, you know, most great companies in tech in the last 30 years have been a series of S curves. So if you zoom way out, it looks like one big hockey stick of growth or value creation. But if you zoom in, it's lots of little wins and moments and twists and turns and pivots that you have to make in order to build a huge company. So one sort of myth of entrepreneurship is, you know, people I think understand it's hard to get product market fit, but I don't think what most entrepreneurs understand is even once you get product market fit, it's not over. Like, it's very rare for a company to just achieve product market fit and then not have to touch or change its sort of strategy or product experience. Like most businesses, you kind of earn the right to go for the next big bet, you know? And so with ClassPass, that's, you know, Pyle had built a whole other company for 3 or 4 years before it was even involved. It went through 3 or 4 turns. Then she had the subscription thing kind of working, but there were some pretty bad problems with that business model. We were unlimited workouts for $100 a month. We were losing money because we had customers using it twice a day, right? Studios and gyms hated us because we were undervaluing the industry. So then we had to say, okay, how do we pivot it? So I think one is just the expectation that to build something great over a long period of time, it's going to be a series of S curves. It's going to be lots of pivots and twists and turns, and to embrace those instead of running away. I mean, so many people are afraid to sort of lose what they've got, that you've got to have the mindset in these situations in such a rapidly evolving industry that what you've got is going to vanish, whether you like it or not. So you got to go innovate on top of that.
And one of the other critical business issues is competition. And it's so interesting because I started in technology in 1992. My first exit with Thomson Reuters and West Publishing was, you know, $3.4 billion in 1995. And competition was already being discussed in the space. And the internet was at its infancy with Cornell.edu and Westlaw and Lexis were basically the only true internet companies in the early 90s that were viable. But competition has been changing as well. And, you know, it's so interesting because I'm doing a lot within the entrepreneurial space. And one of the things I think is so funny is every single industry I hear, oh, but it's so competitive. Well, that's because the whole world is competing now. And we have a platform with, you know, 4.6 billion people and growing on it. And so the exposure and awareness of a product solution or an industry, a career or a job has exponentially accelerated. And so I think it's really important for people to have an idea of perspective of competition and how we deal with the idea of competition. You know, I'll use Apple, which I worked with. I was in the cell phone industry, ran Microsoft's first cell phone, the PCE phone with a CE device in 99. But perspective of competition is interesting because I used to say with Apple, their biggest competitor, you know, right now is the iPhone 12. You know, that's their biggest competitor. So I don't see competition in the same way as everyone. I'd love to get your insight on how you see competition, because I'm sure the first thing people told you, tell you, and will tell you is, oh, it's such a crowded space.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, people have been telling me how crowded it's been for, you know, 20 years that I've been in tech, right? And I graduated from Yale and I went to work at Microsoft. It was the dominant tech company in the early 2000s. Right after the dot-com bubble was crashing, a bunch of people were wiped out. And it's been amazing to see, you know, how many $5 trillion companies emerged from the rubble of the, you know, tech collapse over the last 20 years. And, you know, now it's a question of who's going to get to $5 trillion or $10 trillion first. And I remember when it was crazy to be an angel investor in a unicorn, a $1 billion valuation. Now you got Decacorns and Centacorns and Coinbase over 100 billion market cap and Square, you know, 170. It's just nuts. So, the flip side of the increased global competition due to, you know, pervasive internet access, lowering barriers to entry, to starting a business, to learning how to code. The flip side of that is that there's a heck of a lot more customers than there were 20 years ago, right? Or 30 years ago, in terms of building a successful business. Your reach is just so much. It's almost incomprehensible how big of a business you can build and how quickly you can build it now. But the flip side of that coin is it's way more competitive. And now you're starting to see, you know, for really the first time in the American tech market, you know, foreign competition coming here and having a lot of success in Chinese competition. If you look at ByteDance and TikTok, and I think that's healthy. It's going to cause everyone to level up their game. It's going to be harder than ever, but the stakes are going to be bigger than they've ever been before. So, but to your point, most startups, I don't think die of, you know, murder or homicide. It's usually suicide, right? It's usually unforced errors, co-founder issues, business model decisions. And so, you know, we focus a lot on what we can control and answering our customers and our partners' needs and how to improve on that. And, you know, I like to think each successive time we've changed our model, you know, the last time being about 4 years ago, we moved to a credit system. So it's like it's a subscription, but then you get these points, and inside the subscription, you have a marketplace. You spend it, you know, Barry's Bootcamp peak time class is going to cost more than a lesser known branded and off peak time with less equipment, right? And makes more sense. And all of those things we did, then we built machine learning algorithms that will automatically figure out for a studio or a gym or a pool, how to price their capacity and how much capacity to give us. They don't have to do any work managing ClassPass. They sell as much as they can direct, and then we fill as much as we can of their open spots at the highest possible prices. But we didn't get that day one. We got to that by listening to customers, iterating and making mistakes along the way, and giving ourselves the permission to be wrong, admitting it to the market. Hey, our old model was pretty fucked up. So we moved to this to try to assuage your concerns. And luckily the industry has given us a chance to evolve. We've had lots of, you know, competitive clones. We've had clones who pivoted to other businesses, you know, corporate or other places, but lots of international clones. I mean, a lot of people, foreign entrepreneurs have built pretty good businesses off of finding successful American models and then copying them before they get to Europe or Southeast Asia or whatever. We've been fortunate that we've been able to, you know, build enough competitive advantages and technology advantages, product superiority, and just execution playbook advantages, and also capitalization advantages. You know, when you win in America, you can raise so much more than a local clone in a subscale market that you can bring lots of advantages. And we've been able to do that to build a leadership position, you know, across 30 countries in Southeast Asia and Europe and stuff. So
it's been incredible. And we've talked about what's stable, talked about what's doing well, even through the pandemic, and the only consistency of change. What do you feel is going to be doing well in the future for ClassPass?
Yeah, the pandemic was a curveball I didn't see coming. You know, I always, as an entrepreneur, I'm always trained now to expect the worst can happen, but this was even beyond my comprehension. We'd closed a $285 million financing basically Christmas Eve 2019, and 3 months later, you know, we're shutting our business down proactively. And that was a really tough call. You know, our board was like, hey, we have digital, so do we keep everyone's subscriptions on and they can just use our digital workouts? Well, we actually, you know, decided to proactively stop billing people and say, we don't think it's safe. We don't want you to feel pressured. The sort of ethical reason was, you know, we don't want to charge people to put them into a gym to incentivize them to go in. We don't know if it's safe. The sort of self-interested reason was, you know, even if we forego a lot of revenue in the near term, that'll prevent people from churning. And then when things are safe again, we'll still have a big base of users that we can go reactivate. And it was a tough call, but we took the sort of the right side of history decision and tried to play the long game on it. And it was incredibly painful for us to do that, because we created our revenue, we had to do a bunch of layoffs. But you know, we made it through and we took the long lens, and now we're emerging from the pandemic and things are looking really good. So as I looked at ClassPass's future, it's a lot of the same stuff we talked about a year and a half ago that we just haven't been able to push the ball forward on. So we'll do some more international expansion. There's still some countries that we don't exist in. We're pushing aggressively beyond fitness into kind of spa, salon, wellness. So now you can get a massage, cryo, acupuncture, you know, infrared sauna, a facial through ClassPass. And it turns out these beauty and wellness entrepreneurs have the same marketing challenges and extra capacity challenges that fitness entrepreneurs do. So we've been modifying our app and UI and our algorithms to help work and serve those types of partners as well. So I think you'll see a lot more of that. By the end of this year, ClassPass will be known as much for beauty and wellness experiences as it is fitness experiences. And you know, hopefully we can do what Amazon did in e-commerce and just keep adding new categories, in our case, instead of e-com categories, categories of new activities and experiences, and help people kind of fill their free time with really meaningful stuff that makes them not only healthier, not only lose 70 pounds like I did and actually get 10 more years of life expectancy, but also just mentally, you know, and more fulfilled, right? And filling their free time doing things that they love that are more interesting and helping them become the best, most inspired version of themselves. So that's the super long thesis. And then, you know, we've built a big corporate program out now. So we have Amazon, Starbucks, Goldman Sachs, Facebook, Google, United Airlines, all as clients. And they just use us to sort of, their benefits team says, hey, rather than trying to cut a deal with a particular gym or a couple studios, we'll just give you ClassPass and subsidize it. So
it's absolutely genius. I'm sitting here thinking to myself, I wish Steve Gu would have introduced me to you 20 years ago, because I have so many people on here and it's like, man, talk about knowledge and skill all combined in great capability with desire. I'm definitely coming up to Montana to see you. Incredible lessons.
Please do.
And playbook to success. Only question I have for you or request is, please let me know the next thing you invest in. I can save myself a lot of time and make a lot of money. So thank you so much. I love your perspective. Fritz Landman, CEO of ClassPass, a serial entrepreneur and investor. Thank you so much for joining me. Well, I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of The Playbook as much as me. On a personal note, I just wanted to thank everyone for making The Playbook such a success. Don't forget to continue it by sharing, subscribing, and listening to your favorite episodes. This is Dave Meltzer with The Playbook.